My conversation today is with author, practitioner, and devotee of the Egyptian goddess Isis, Isadora Forrest. Isadora has been a key contributor in the communities of Neo-Egyptian magic, pagan spirituality, and Golden Dawn magic and related ceremonial traditions. As a longtime devotee and priestess of the goddess Isis and author of the books Isis Magic and Offering to Isis, both first released in the early 2000s, she and I sat down to talk about her experiences as devotee, being called to and cultivating a relationship with a deity, the Egyptian magic of the Hermetica, the assumption of deity forms, and much more. Isadora also writes a blog on the goddess Isis and her experiences as a devotee and priestess to her entitled Isiopolis, a votive work in honor of the goddess Isis. So, settle in for an advanced conversation on ceremonial magic with an experienced priestess, magician, and wordsmith. I'm Ike Baker, and this is the Arcanum Podcast. Great. So this is excellent. Isadora Forrest, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to chat with me. I'm really excited. I know that we are frater and soror of the same order, but we don't really know each other. This is the first time we've really had any in-depth conversation. And I'm really interested in a lot of your output. Particularly stuff on that you've written for the Light Extended Journals and your blog, Isiopolis. But I'd like to know some of your background. How'd you get started and what path led you to where you are today?
Well, it's great to meet you too, Ike. And I've seen you are really busy right now too. The new Hermopolis and some conferences and all kinds of stuff. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me as well.
Of course.
I'm old now, so I've been doing this. I've been a dedicated priestess of Isis for 40 years, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Yes, I did start young.
Yeah.
And so my primary path is pagan, and I have a couple of deities that I specifically work with, although, you know, one is polytheist and all gods are wonderful. As many of you, any of you who know me will know that Isis is my primary goddess, and I've been with her for a long time. And some of you may know that I'm also dedicated to Dionysos. I felt like I wanted a god as well as a goddess to work with. And I tried with Osiris, and he, as beautiful and wonderful as he is, it was Dionysos who said, hello.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. But what I wanted to ask you, have you ever been to Pompeii?
I have. I have. It's one of my favorite places, geographic locations on the earth.
Yes. So if you were there and were able to visit the Temple of Isis that's there.
Yeah, I didn't actually go to the Temple of Isis there. As you know, in sites like that, they like some sections are like partitioned off, you know, there's work mm-hmm. being done or something. I did get to the Villa of the Mysteries there, which had its own kind of Dionysian flavor. It was very, very interesting.
Oh, it does indeed have that flavor. And we did get to go there as well.
What brought you to Isis?
I've been working hermetic magic for a little while. And I've been doing a lot of work with my local pagan community. And at some point, I just decided I needed a patroness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of opened myself up to see if there was anybody looking for me.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually found her. And in fact, when she first started kind of showing up for me, I was like, I don't really want to do Isis. Everybody does Isis. And since, as I told you, that was about 40 years ago, I was a bit of a rebel at the time. And I was like, now I have to do something special. But nevertheless, she was insistent. And here I am.
I've not necessarily done. I started some devotional work with thought early on, and I was like, I'm kind of not ready for this. I need to focus on what's in front of me, because it was pretty early on. And I know that you had written a blog about being called by a deity. And I wanted to explore some of those topics. How can one really know, for the listeners today, how can one really know the right path? It's interesting that you say you didn't want to do it, but they were persistent. So how are they persistent? How do they call you?
I think for some people, it really depends on how you're perceiving things. I've always had a really easy relationship with magic. That's not true for everybody. Some people find it much more disruptive in, let's say, their auras. But I've always been very comfortable with it. I'm comfortable with weird things. I'm comfortable with strange things happening. And if you're either not interested in it, it feels really uncomfortable for you, or you're not used to it. Signs and symbols from the deities sometimes can be disturbing and off-putting rather than attractive. But if we're assuming people are kind of out there asking, is Isis calling me, or is any deity calling me? How do you know? It's really kind of simple things that is all are also very easy to blow off sometimes. Like the name will keep coming up. You'll keep coming across things that you're reading that are associated with that deity, animals associated with the deity, names associated with the deity just kind of keep coming into your consciousness. And if you're open to it and you're listening, you're going to hear a lot more of them. But I know for some people that's not. It can be much stronger, like a really powerful dream. Dreams seem to work a lot for folks. I'm a bad dreamer. So I don't really speak well to that, but I do visionary work much, much more often. How does that work for you?
I used to really spend a lot of time in dream work, and the last 2 years, I barely remember that. I remember maybe like three dreams a year now. And I've employed the same techniques. I've always used recall in reverse. I've used tokens at my bedside. I've even taken like mugwort, spagyric tinctures and things like this, and nothing seems to be working. So I think that in and of itself to me is a message, because I'm in a lot of Adeptus minor degree right now, and that the meal on my plate in front of me, right? Job, house, all those things, it has been overwhelming the past I've moved 3 times in the last 3 years. So it's kind of, I've got to dig in right now, sink roots in. But I spend a lot of I like the Greek stuff. I'm Greek ethnically. My father was from Greece. He came here like when he was in his mid-20s. So I spent the summers there as a kid. Every summer for like 3 months we'd go. I still try and go every year. Unfortunately, I don't think I'll make it this year, but
I wonder.
yeah, but I like to work with those god forms and those that pantheon, but they tend to be, I find, and I think you had written something about this. I'm not sure if it was you or Adam, but the Egyptian gods are a little bit more stable. The Greek pantheon, especially even in my own experiences, it's very operatic. And it's less, there's a lot of needs. It's very fickle. And especially if you're doing god form work, I found that like there's a species of automatonism, where it's like I'm having a little bit of trouble controlling these things. It could just be that I've worked the Z formulas for so long that I kind of like I can do that now. But the Greek god forms, they don't listen. And you know what? Neither do Greek people. So
Something you said just a second ago reminded me of that comparison of Greek and Egyptian, and it's one of the Hermetica, and the main speaker, I don't remember if it's Asclepius or who it is that's speaking, or maybe it's Trismegistus, but anyway, he says that Egyptian sounds are words full of action, and Greek words are full of flowery foolsoffery, he says. And you find that. I mean, you find that if you look at like the Greco-Egyptian magical papyri, the Greek spells can be very written, and the Egyptian spells are like, dum, 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 dum. Get
Yes.
it done.
Yeah, very precise, very precise. And I think that explains a lot about me for sure. One question that I always had, I'm a little bit more on the timid side. Maybe that's because I grew up Catholic, but I'm not the adventurous type, like chick or somebody where I'm just going to jump into something and try it. I have to really do my research and ease my way into things like this. But something that I'm curious about is I've known some people who kind of act as a hierophant or hierophantrix in the material world as a mediator for a certain deific power beyond the veil. And it kind of comes through them. How is that different from devotional work, or is there a component of it?
Well, versus devotional work, that's always more private. And if you're doing something public like that, there's a certain formality to it that would be, at least for me, very different if I'm let's say channeling Isis for a ritual versus if I'm just kind of inhabiting her god form for communion. Or even, I mean, I usually don't even take on the god form and that kind of thing. It's more of a talk back and forth. She is present in my shrine and we can converse with each other.
Yeah, that's been pretty interesting for me is, the assumption of God form work has been a real boon in my personal practice. And, I'm not really sure how familiar some of the listeners are or may be about God form work. I've kind of very cursorily mentioned it and things like this, but it's a little bit more advanced for where I am on my channel. I'm kind of just talking about the underlying theory behind things. As you kind of have to approach this stuff. I think the right way to do it is to approach it foundationally. You just build that first layer, work on top of that, keep going. But what do you think are some of the important things about God form work? The basics.
Yeah, in kind of in preparation for our talk today, I did a lot of Googling yesterday. I wanted to kind of just see what was out there in terms of what questions people were asking about God forms, or shall I say deity form. I'm trying to
Right.
desex the language, and it's hard for me because I'm old, so give me time. But deity form. So I went out there and I was just kind of looking to see what people were looking at and what they were doing. And some in really interesting things were being done out there. Very basic questions. What is a god form? And we should in fact talk about that. Should I worship a god form? And then people kind of discussing some of the different techniques and things that they use. But for me, having been trained in a Hermetic magical background, I basically do some kind of version of the standard GD God form assumption. But there are many different ones, and I'm actually trying to do some work for myself to find more Egyptian methods of doing that. We have lots of records showing that they used it. Any of the and it's one of the things that kind of freaked the Greeks out about Egyptian magic too, because it was hubristic to them, and it is, which is why you have to watch it.
That's a good point.
So what we're talking about is, okay, basic god form assumption is, on a very simple level, I've defined it as the voluntary taking on of the imaginal form of a deity. And imaginal form is just what it sounds like, is you imagine in your head, in your mind's eye, what the deity might look like. Now, some people can do that all internally. Some rituals might call for it to be so that you can see the form, especially if you're using one of the Hermetic formulas. Generally, you'll build up a great image of the deity that you want to work with, and then kind of step into that form at some point. And if you do it, if you're really visualizing well, and you've got kind of your human self and consciousness, and then the deity is surrounding you, you should be able to kind of simultaneously do things. And that's good, because you want to be able to have that separation. Then, to fully take on the god form, you imagine your human self growing to fit that larger image. And it's really a ritualistic way to just step into a channel of some of the many streams of energy that would come off of any given deity.
It is very different than being what they call, I guess, like ridden by the deity. You know, you have to kind of wear it almost like as a, I think, I'm not sure if the name of the article or the subtitle was it, but I think one of the pieces that you wrote for the Light Extended about God form assumption was, I wear the cloak of the great lady. I am the great, I
And
have become the great lady, or something like that. So you do wear it almost like a costume. When I assume the god form, I'm kind of looking through the eyes of Osiris. It feels like this gigantic mask.
one of the things I wanted to mention about what we're just talking about, with the kind of the feeling of the deity around you and then your human self, was one of the things that way back then in Iamblichus' day, like third, fourth century, I think, is he says that the human being has two aspects when in divine conjunction, one as a human being and one as the very form of the gods, which is where God form comes from.
Oh, okay. That's where the
And
actual verbiage comes from.
it's really interesting to really see some scholars that I've been reading now and a long time ago, but they actually come to use the word assumption of God form, not because of any of the magical reading they've been doing, but the historical reading that they've been doing. And they look at it and say, ah, I can see what's happening here to this person, or with this person. And if you're doing back to personal work, if we're doing personal work and you're having that feeling, you can let yourself go a little bit more and allow yourself to become more in that stream of consciousness of the divinity that you're working with. One of the ways that I have a group of friends who do Bacchic work, and one of the things that we do when we gather in circle is called masks. And as you probably know, Dionysos has many, many, many different faces, many different masks. So, and each of them exemplified by one of his epithets. So we've gathered a bunch of epithets. We put them on little cards, just like a tarot deck or something. And Adam did the design work for us on that. And I put it in a basket, and we'll draw one of these masks out. And I am getting to a point, which is that this is practice for God form. We put on, envision one of the masks, and every person has to speak what they're feeling through this mask. And one of the rules is you must say I. You can't kind of sideswipe being in God form. You must say, I do this, and I feel this, and I want this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I love that because it sounds fun.
It's really fun. Sometimes we get, really joyous aspects of the god. Sometimes we get very serious aspects of the god. And no deity is going to hurt you unless you're purposely, you could probably invoke some form that would be not gentle with you. But any deity that you invoke in that way is just they're not going to hurt you.
Yeah, it's really an attenuated form of the deity. It's not like this
Yeah.
full
Not Cather.
Yeah. I'm wondering, have you ever had, I mean, what's your opinion on how much the individual ruach will affect the expression of the deity? I mean, does it have the flavor of the person? I mean, it kind of has to, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. And that we are having an embodied experience. We are human beings living in bodies right now, and the brains and the guts and the heart that we have to do all these spiritual things is right here. This is where it starts. It's not where it ends. Our bodies are Malkuth, but we've got all the other Sephiroth that we can touch, at least in a little way.
Now, there's a lot of Egyptian stuff that a lot of Egyptian questions that I wanted to ask you because I don't get people. I get a lot of people that are into like Neoplatonism and theurgy and even like, Norse paganism, but I don't really get to talk to people who are into the Egyptian deity form work and stuff like that. So, but I think I want to ask you at this point about your time in Egypt. I'd really like to hear about that and like the time you had and what you saw and anything you felt.
Oh, well, we have 1,200 pictures to show for it, which we are not intending to inflict on anyone.
Yeah.
But we had a great time. It was certainly a trip of a lifetime for me. We spent a good 2 weeks. I would say that a highlight was actually being on the Nile. We took one of the smaller boats, the Dahabiya, and you're just there. You're just there. You're on the great river, and to either side is green, 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 and then desert, desert, desert. And it was the same for them. For all the people that worshipped My Lady and all the other Egyptian gods and goddesses, that's what it was like for them too. And one of the other things that really struck me was we went into all the temples that we could, the major ones, and nothing felt too big to me. It's huge. It's monumental architecture, but actually being inside it was very normal feeling to me, very human connected. And that, I think, is one of the things about the Egyptian deities that we don't usually think of, that we have a more of a formal idea about the ancient Egyptians, but the connections with the deities can be very intimate. There's a collection of, I think they're on Ostraca, poems and hymns and writings by a particular priest of Isis and Thoth, and he's from a later period, but he's really Egyptian, and you can tell from his writings. And his name is Hor, Horus, son of Isis, and we have some of his writings and the intimacy with which he writes to both his deities, Isis and Thoth, strikes me right in the heart. And I think even in like some of the Greco-Egyptian magical papyri, we find that same intimacy. There's one of my favorite spells, if prayers from the papyri, is one where the person is talking directly to Hermes, and they say, I am you and you are me. I am in you, you are in me. I know you and you know me. And even as far back as the pyramid text, there is one text that is so heartfelt that it also strikes me right in the heart. And it says, I'm not going to quote it exactly because I don't remember it exactly, but it's something like, the fire is laid, the fire shines. The incense is put upon the fire, the incense shines. And there are a few other things like that. And then, I come to you, my God. You come to me, my God. And the people who are doing Egyptian work, and it's a big range too, but I think they also feel some of those kind of very personal, intimate connections with the deities, which is one of the things that makes them so popular with a certain group. There are reconstructionists, comedics, and then there are people who are like me, who are kind of in between. I don't try to recreate the ancient rites, but I am inspired entirely by them. And I think Greco-Egyptian.
Yeah, because we have that bridge in our deity form work of the Coptic. That's kind of the synthesis of the Greek and the Egyptian right there, those two cultures. But it's really interesting. The one temple when I was there that really hit me was Dendera. And
Oh, yeah.
we hadn't intended on going there. We just kind of ended up there. You know, and obviously in Egypt, you need special passes to like travel, and we didn't know about that, how like a lot of the roads are closed unless you get special dispensation. But we ended up going to Dendera, and it just so happened we realized it afterward. It was on Mother's Day, and it really, really struck me. And it's definitely a highlight for me of that whole trip, and probably of like anywhere I've been in the in that area. And what was interesting is that was from the Greco-Egyptian period, the Hellenistic period, actually, that temple. It wasn't actually from the older kingdoms and the
Right.
earlier dynasties. And it was
Oh,
part of that is it's
almost all of them are that.
I mean, so the part of it was that it's so well preserved in there. You know, not a lot of these places are, I mean, the Valley of the Kings, sure, because they were underground. But a lot of places in Egypt, I don't know if a lot of people realize that, but there was a lot of grave robbing that happened, and left the spaces kind of destitute.
Yep. Well, Dendera was one of the highlights for me as well. What we did to get past the checkpoints is we hired a guide. And in fact, we kind of did that throughout Egypt because we don't really enjoy the group tour thing that much. So we hired a guide that would just do me and Adam. And we did that for Dendera. So luckily, blessedly, he took care of all the paperwork and things that we need, and we could just enjoy what was there. But Dendera was amazing. I spent most of my time like looking up at the ceilings.
And it's interesting too, because like then doing you get over it, because it's like, if there's juice flowing, there's juice flowing. But when I got back, I was like, well, how the hell am I going to do magic in my basement now, or like this room? They had these massive halls. Why couldn't I have been born a priest back then? But yeah, I it was a magical place for me. I'm glad that you guys got to go. I'm interested in did you do any ritual work you want while you were there, or is that an off the record conversation?
Well, I did at Philae because, well, that is Isis temple. And Philae is magical, but I must say that it was so crowded compared to really any of the other temples that we visited, that it was a little bit hard to find space to do it. So I am good at visualization, however. And we did have a little adventure on Philae, as I was wearing a couple of necklaces. One of them was a sistrum, and one is a knot of Isis. And I did not come back with the knot of Isis, not because I put it anywhere. I just came back without it. She had taken it. So that was her offering. And the guy was, I noticed it on the boat back, and I went, aha, she took it. And the guy's like, oh, I can go back and we can look for it. I'm like, no. This is an offering for her, and she shall have it. We loved, I mean, Philae is truly the most beautiful temple. But did you know it is also the temple with the most graffiti on it?
No, I actually I didn't get there. I didn't manage to get there.
It is the temple. Well, because it is so beautiful, people wanted to visit it from all ages. They always have. And every single one of them seemed like they had to write their name on the temple. We have demotic graffiti, we have hieroglyphic graffiti, we have English graffiti, French graffiti.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about now. I was kind of at first I was thinking, like spray paint or something. But I remember being in the Valley of the Kings, and over some of the doorways there, you'd see like the early English. I didn't. That's it must have been cool to see demotic graffiti, because I didn't get to see that.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing about the particularly the ancient graffiti, not I entirely blame any English and French graffiti on the temple. You should not be there. But the more ancient graffiti was not just putting their mark on a place, but wanting to leave something that would be there with the deity for all time. Sometimes you'll see, and I bet you've seen this too, because it would sometimes occur at Greek temples, is footprints where people have kind of outlined their two footprints standing on a temple step or somewhere on the temple grounds. And it just means, I am here before the deity for all time.
That's a wonderful sentiment behind that, and I wasn't aware of that. So
It takes some of the sting out of all the marks on the temples.
it does. And you know what? It kind of, when they're in ruins like that, I mean, that's an act of you're resacralizing, you're still going there and making that spot holy because of the intention that you're having there, and the presence that you're bringing to it, the acknowledgement of the indwelling battery of power that it is for that force. That acknowledgement kind of, I think, would probably contribute to the resacralization, or just the maintenance of it when they've been. I mean, these places have been desecrated. In Dendera, it was really interesting how they had, I think the Persians, maybe they had gone in there, and chipped away. They do graffiti, not graffiti, but they do like vandalism to the graven images, because. Because I think my idea behind it, and tell me what you think, is that, they were empowering these things, most likely. There was some species of Heka that was present in their images in these, especially a holy temple like Dendera, which was not a public center of political power and a show of prestige. That was for priests, that place, and people would come to be healed and things like that. But they were so they would go in and break apart the image because it was holy.
And well, we have just seen that in Iran not too long ago. It's the same reason. But that was in fact one of the things that kind of struck me going in all the temples. I knew that that had happened to them, but I didn't know the extent to which it had happened. It's almost universal, unless, it was so high that somebody couldn't reach it. And that is very painful.
I can't wait to go back. I hope you guys get to go back as well. You were talking about, this reconstruction, how you're more on the inspired sort of track. So I'm assuming that with your deity form work, you're pulling things from the Hermetica and things like that in order to sort of amplify it, or how are you approaching that specifically, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I've mentioned earlier that because I've been trained in the Hermetic tradition, that's kind of the basis of what I've been doing. But I also like to do some more Egyptianizing of some of those things. So there, if you go back in the ancient Egyptian texts, and I'm not sure which one of the ancient texts it is, but there's a beautiful, there, well, there are many beautiful rituals for assumption of deity form that I think you could actually use just as they are and make it happen. But there's one, okay, it is the Book of the Dead. I'm checking my sources. And it identifies the dead person, or let's say the live person trying to take on God form, kind of quality by quality with the deity Re, the sun god. So it's like his sun disk is your sun disk. His rays are your rays. His crown is your crown. His greatness is your greatness. And it goes on for quite a long time. I mean, I can imagine sitting in a meditative state, either reciting it if I had memorized it, which would be best, or having someone read it to me, which is also good, and imagining each of those qualities of the deity kind of coming to you, in you, through you, however you want to describe that. And that you could actually take on the God form of Ray from this little ritual. So that's the kind of things that I want to adapt, inspired entirely by a true ancient text, but adapting it to my work with Isis specifically, or any other Egyptian deity. But she's my girl, and I'm her
Yeah.
girl.
I mean, it's really cool to hear this kind of stuff, you know, and it's just a testament to what you can do if you have a really strong foundation in this stuff. And then now, especially, right, because you're probably one of the most practiced magicians that I've spoken with on this podcast. And there is, as we were kind of talking off camera earlier, there is a lot of translation work that's coming to the fore right now. There's tremendous amount to be done, granted, but there's a lot more that academia is. They've kind of be taken an interest in this kind of stuff, which is great in a lot of ways. And simultaneously, it's, you know, magic and these Egyptian magical texts and Greco-Egyptian stuff, it's penetrating into the mainstream. You know, now that the kind of witch talk thing is subsiding, and people that were we all go through that phase. I mean, that's how I was the same way when I came to magic. It's unavoidable, but eventually you mature into it if you stick with it. And so you're seeing a lot more of those people coming through now. And so I'm interested to get your thoughts, you know, because not all of them have the training that like something like the Golden Dawn gives you, which is it's broad, but it's very, very, at the same time, it's focused on these protocols that allow you to be able to transpose what you're doing. And as you say, you have a hermetic background in that magic. What are your thoughts on these modern paradigms of magic and you know, this new age that we're entering?
I am thrilled beyond description with the scholarly work that's being done on magic in the last few decades. It has just multiplied and multiplied, and there are so many more things available to us amateurs. I would in no way consider myself a real scholar, but I am definitely an amateur scholar in the true sense of the word, in that I love it. You do what you do what you love. And now that I'm retired, I get to do it all the time.
Nice.
So I'm excited about all the new things that people are doing. And I'm thrilled and amazed at how many really good magicians are doing really good work out there. I belong to the PGM list, and some of the folks on that are doing amazing work, and I congratulate them for doing that and for giving me access to that work. They will inspire me now too.
That's great. That's excellent. So I, obviously I have a couple of canned questions that everybody gets as we come to the end of our conversation. What are three books that you would recommend to any listeners that have heard some of our conversation today and might be interested in developing some of the ideas and learning more about them?
Well, depending on, which part is of interest to you, if you're just starting to get interested in anything about ISIS and you're just kind of at level zero, read almost anything on ancient Egyptian religion. Is just get some background in the whole culture so that you can fit a particular deity that you might be interested in into that culture, because they are all part of it. And a good book that is, I'd say it is scholarly, but it's not beyond the reach of a lot of people, is Conceptions of God in Ancient Egypt. I have this book. Conceptions of God in Ancient Egypt, Eric Horning. That's good for basic background. I wish I could recommend my book, Isis Magic, but it's out of print right now for those who are specifically ISIS interested. We will probably be doing a print on demand at some point with
Oh,
that.
great, great.
Let's see. And if you're a word geek, basic hieroglyphs are something to take a look at. Most of the stuff that I've been reading lately is on the more scholarly end. And I think that's one of the things that I was addressing with Isis Magic in terms of her, that gives you all the background, but also gives you practice. Most of the good ISIS-specific work is scholarly work at this point. If you read French, Laurent Bricot is doing a lot of good modern work. I can, with
That's
the help of Google Translate, me in
great.
French. J. Gwynne Griffiths does a lot of good scholarly work on ISIS. There's one called The ISIS Book, where he takes Apuleius' work, which is the only account of a mystery initiation that we have, the only first-person account, even though it's ostensibly fictional. And then he analyzes that and connects it up with some of the more ancient lore about Egypt. So this is one of my favorites. He's definitely one of my favorite scholars.
Yeah, that sounds like I something I would really want to get my hands on.
Yep. For God form specific things, I'm not really aware of a specific book that kind of gives you that. Do you know of any?
I can't remember. I know Chick and Tabby have a book where I think Tabby describes it. I don't know if it's in Golden Dawn Magic, the one that came out in 2019. But it's not the way that, like, it's just the first couple of
Part of it.
steps. Yeah,
Right.
you don't get the whole thing. I've never seen the whole thing anywhere, so.
Yeah. So, the reason I wrote that whole I put on the cloak article was that I was wanting, in fact, to trace the kind of the history of God forms. And I don't know, maybe that needs to be done. I ended up with like 30 pages, which is longer than I thought it would be.
I enjoyed it so much, especially because I think you focus on Nephthys there also at a certain point, I believe, right?
Oh, well, she has recently come knocking at my door. So yeah, I've been doing some work with her as well.
Right. I noticed that in the article, and as Imperator here at the Asheville Temple, like that's the god form I have to work with. So it actually ended up being perfect, and I would actually recommend that to anybody that wants to get a flavor for God form work. Your article in the Light Extended, I think it's volume 2 or volume 1.
I think it's the first one. Yeah, it's the first
Yes.
one.
Okay, so Light Extended Volume One, you've and because it really does, so much of it is kind of figuring out not just the mechanics, but kind of as you were alluding to earlier, like what you're doing when you've assumed it, and how it's got that invocatory principle, where you go from, you are this, you are that, you are mighty, to I am this, I am the god, I am the goddess, that kind of invocatory formula where it starts out as objective and becomes
Right.
subjective.
And that's the very famous Stele of You, source of the Bornless ritual, has that same sort of structure.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But
Yeah.
very cool. Do you have anything that you want to anything going on in the future that you want to plug or mention or talk about?
Well, I am working on a new book, but it's not going to be anything anytime soon. I've started research on it basically. And so that'll be coming out. But yes, there is actually a reprint of my offering to Isis, which is not the first Isis magic book, but it's a second book. And it takes 72 symbols associated with Isis and kind of gives you a little bit of a history of them, and also gives you a invocation offering of each of them. And an invocation offering is a spoken offering, and this is also an actual Egyptian technique. Sometimes you'll see them if you visited the tombs. Somewhere in the tomb, there may be a request for the living person to not only speak the name of the deceased, but to also speak offerings to them. The standard formula is like 1,000 of bread and 1,000 of beer, and that's an invocation offering. In Egyptian, it's the going forth of the voice, Peret Keru. And so back to offering, some of those are included for each of the 72 symbols, so that it's, and it also gives you some rituals that you can do to make offering to Isis using her important symbols.
That's
So that one is going to be coming out later this year.
excellent. That sounds great. Who's releasing it?
Azoth Press. So what they do at first is they do a hardcover fancy edition for the collectors, and then once that's sold through, they'll do a paperback version. So that's of course the paperback is the one I'm excited about for people who haven't been able to get hold of that book for a while because it's been out of print for a while.
Yeah, there's been a lot of gems from that early, from just that whole class, of magical practitioners and stuff that have, they've become rarities in their own lifetime, It's like it's been pretty cool to see that. I've got a couple of them on my shelf. But I appreciate you so much. I also want to tell listeners to check out your blog, Issyopolis.com, right? Okay.
And if you want to contact me, you can contact me through the blog. That was fine. People do write to me.
Great. Yeah, that's excellent. There's definitely a lot of digestible insights there, for people that want to get into this stuff. And I appreciate your time. I appreciate all the work that you've done for the order, for magic in general. And I'm honored that you sat down with me today. So thanks so much. I'm looking forward to everything else you've got going in the future.
Well, thank you so much, Ike. Thanks for Arcanum. I listened to a lot of them and really enjoyed the interview. So thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. And thank you all you listeners. Thanks.